My name is Tom DeHaven, and I'd like to welcome everybody to the 15th annual VCU Cabell First Novelist Award.
When we started this,
my friend Laura Browder and I, in the MFA program, we had this idea that our students would benefit from needing published writers, but also benefit professionally from learning how it works with agents and editors. And that's how this started. We went to the dean of the College of Humanities and Sciences with our hat in our hand and said, would you support this? And we got $5,000 one time. From that, we put on the award. The first year was at the Richmond Public Library. Since then, we've been rolling. We've got David Baldacci, who was an alumnus of VCU, to support us for 5 years. And then the Cabell Library took over. So we're still going strong. And this is our first year here in this new library. The First Novelist Committee wants to thank the VCU libraries, the Friends of the Libraries, the Cabell Associates, who make so much of this possible, the College of Humanities and Sciences, Department of English, and the MFA program in creative writing. I'd like to thank Barnes & Noble. I want to thank our readers. You know, this is a little strange literary award that it's kind of like the roadside fruit and vegetable literary award. We get the books, and readers in Richmond read the books. Students here, professors, members of the library who love novels, go online and put their evaluations, and then at the end of the year we pick the top 10, and then it goes to the committee and we pick the top 3, and it goes out to the 3 judges to pick the winner and evaluate it for us. So I want to thank the readers. I want to thank our judges. I'd like to thank the First Novelist Committee, Tom Dodato, Kate Zipsy, my friend Laura Browder. I'd like to thank the people who really run this award. This is run by graduate students. The 2 coordinators of this award, Julie Gein and Cade Varnado. So thank you again, and the introductory remarks always go to the Cabell Fellow. And this year, Cade Varnado is the Cabell Fellow and will introduce Angela to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tom. Hi, I'm Cade Varnado. I'm the Cabell Fellow and the coordinator of this award. As the second and last person in this chain of introductions, let me say again, welcome, and I promise not to go on too long. This is my 3rd year working on the Cabell Award, and my 2nd as coordinator. In this time, we have averaged close to 150 submissions per year. To borrow a phrase from Newman on Seinfeld, the mail never stops. It just keeps coming and coming and coming. There's never a let up. It is relentless. But relentless though it may be, it's also incredibly rewarding work for a writer early in his career, in that it provides you with examples of what a successfully published first novel looks like. We receive many worthy, well-written, imaginative works of fiction every year, and it is a pleasure to read and discuss their merits. One complaint I might levy against the job, though, is that after years of reading many books, you start to get good, perhaps too good, at predicting the direction a book is headed in, even with a great book. You realize early on that the child who loses his parents in a freak accident at 5 is probably going to have issues once he leaves that orphanage, but will grow up to be an actualized person regardless. Or that the first-time bank robber is about to have a rough go of things. And while many such novels are still enjoyable, touching, vital, it's a rare delight to chance upon a novel that is unpredictable. Enter The Turner House. The Turner House begins with a haunting. It ends with a whole cast of characters getting up and dancing. It spans more than half a century of Detroit history, from the manufacturing boom that began during the Second World War to the city's decline in the modern era. It's a novel about the idiosyncrasies we use to show our family that we love them, and conversely, how we betray that love. It's a novel about addiction, about homes and homelessness, about faith, about therapy, all this and a ghost too. Rube Goldberg could not have devised so many moving parts, nor so perfect a synchronicity. It's true then, what the book tells us, that there ain't no party like a Turner House party. Like a single-celled organism, it can change shape and reproduce itself. All first-time writers, I should think, want their book to make a big splash. I do. This has led to the creation of many ill-conceived and now forgotten pastiches written only with the market in mind. With the Turner House, Angela Flournoy proves that a first novel can and should be ambitious and complex, that a first novel can be a masterpiece. I hope you can tell by now that the Turner House stood out, not so much like a sore thumb, more like a thumb that's perfectly photogenic, one of those one in a million thumbs that grows on a hand model. I loved this book. Everyone on the committee loved it. It was one of those rare submissions that people actually volunteered to read of their own free will. And that's how much I talked it up. Of course, I'm hardly the first person to praise it. The National Book Foundation deemed it a major new contribution to the story of the American family. The New York Times hailed it as assured and memorable, engrossing and remarkably mature, artful without being showy. The Sydney Morning Herald, yes, they even loved this book in Australia, called it masterly. And so it is. Please join me in welcoming the author of The Turner House, 2016 VCU Cabell First Novelist, Angela Flournoy.
I've never been so honored to be described as a photogenic thumb before. I also am very fond of roadside fruit and vegetable stands, so I am very honored to have this award. Thank you to everyone who contributed to bringing me out here and to honoring me tonight. I thought I would read about Haints, which follow one character throughout my book. I'm gonna start in the beginning and then I'm gonna jump around some. Trouble in the Big Room. The eldest six of Francis and Viola's 13 children claim that the big room of the house on Yarrow Street was haunted for at least one night. A ghost, a haint if you will, tried to pull Cha-Cha out of the big room's second story window. The big room was not in actuality very big, could hardly be considered a room. For some other family, it might have made a decent storage closet or a mother's cramped sewing room. For the Turners, it became the only single occupancy bedroom in their overcrowded house, a rare and coveted space. In the summer of 1958, Cha-Cha, the eldest at 14 years, was in the throes of a gangly-legged, croaky-voiced adolescence. Smelling himself, Viola called it. Tired of sharing a bed with younger brothers who peed and kicked and drooled and blanket-hogged, Cha-Cha woke up one evening, untangled himself from his brother's errant limbs, and stumbled into the whatnot closet across the hall. He slept on the floor, curled up with his back against dusty boxes, and started a tradition. From then on, when one Turner child got grown and gone, as Francis described it, the next eldest child crossed the threshold into the big room. The haunting, according to the older children, occurred during the very same summer that the big room became a bedroom. Lonnie, the youngest child then, was the first to witness the Haints attack. He just began visiting the bathroom alone and was headed there when he had the opportunity to save his brother's life. Three-year-olds were of a tenuous reliability, but to this day, Lonnie recalls the form of a pale-hued young man lifting Cha-Cha by his pajama collar out of the bed and toward the narrow window. Back then, a majority of the homeowners in that part of Detroit's east side were still white, and the city had no empty lots. Cha-Cha sneaking out! Cha-Cha sneaking out with a white boy, Lonnie sang. He stamped his little feet on the floorboards. Soon Quincy and Russell spilled into the hallway. They saw Cha-Cha, all elbows and fists, swinging at the haint. It had let go of Cha-Cha's collar and was now on the defensive. Quincy would later insist that the haint emitted a blue, electric-looking light, and each time Cha-Cha's fist connected with its body, the entire thing flickered like a faulty lamp. Seven-year-old Russell fainted. Little Lonnie stood transfixed, a pool of urine at his feet, his eyes open wide. Quincy banged on his parents' locked bedroom door. Viola and Francis Turner were not in the habit of waking up to tend to ordinary child nightmares or bedwetting kerfluffles. Francie, the eldest girl at 12, burst into the crowded hallway just as Cha-Cha was giving the haint his worst. She would later say the haint's skin had a jellyfish-like translucency, and the pupils of its eyes were huge, dark discs. Let him go and run, Cha-Cha, Francie said. He ain't running me out of here, Cha-Cha yelled back. With the exception of Lonnie, who had been crying, the four children in the hallway fell silent. They'd heard plenty of tales of mischievous haints from their cousins down south. They pushed people into wells, made hangmen dance in midair. So it did not follow that a spirit from the other side would have to spend several minutes fighting off a territorial 14-year-old. Francie possessed an aptitude for level-headedness in the face of crisis. She decided she'd seen enough of this paranormal beatdown. She marched into Chacha's room, grabbed her brother by a stretched out collar, and dragged him into the hall. She slammed the big room door behind them and pulled Chacha to the floor. They landed in Lonnie's piss. "That ain't trying to run me out of the room," Chacha said. He wore the indignant look, eyebrows raised, lips parted, of someone who has suffered an unbearable affront. "There ain't no Haints in Detroit," Francis Turner said. His children jerked at the sound of his voice. That was how he existed in their lives, suddenly there, on his own time, his quiet authority augmenting the air in a room. He stepped over their skinny brown legs and opened the big room's door. Francis Turner called Chacha into the room. Then when it was open and the beige sheets from Chacha's bed hung over the sill, "Look under the bed," Chacha looked. "Behind the dresser, nothing there. Put them sheets back where they belong." Chacha obliged, his father's eyes on him as he worked. When he finished, he sat down on the bed, unprompted, and rubbed his neck. Francis Turner sat next to him. "Ain't no Haints in Detroit, son." He did not look at Chacha. "It tried to run me out of the room. I don't know what all happened, but it wasn't that." Chacha opened his mouth and closed it. "If you ain't grown enough to sleep by yourself, I suggest you move on back across the hall." Francis Turner stood up to go, faced his son. He reached for Chacha's collar, pulled it open, and put his index finger to the line of irritated skin below the Adam's apple. For a moment, Chacha saw the specter of true panic in his father's eyes. Then Francis's face settled into an ambivalent frown. "That'll be gone in a day or two," he said. In the hallway, the other children stood lined up against the wall. Marlene, child number 5 and a bit sickly, had finally come out of the girls' room. "Francie and Quincy, clean up Lonnie's mess, and all y'all best go to sleep. I don't want to hear nobody talking about they tired come morning." Francis Turner closed his bedroom door. The mess was cleaned up, but no one, not even little Lonnie, slept in the right bed that night. How could they, with the windows puffing out and sucking in like gauzy lungs in the breeze? The children crowded into Chacha's room, a privileged first visit for most of them, and were told versions of the night's events. There were many disagreements about the Haint's appearance and whether it had said anything during the tussle with Chacha. Quincy claimed the thing had winked at him as he stood in the hallway, which meant that the big room should be his. Francie said that Haints didn't have eyelids, so it couldn't have winked at all. Marlene insisted that she'd been in the hall with the rest of them throughout the ordeal, but everyone teased her for showing up late to the show. In the end, the only thing agreed upon was that the Haint was real and that living with it was the price one had to pay for having the big room. Everyone, Chacha included, thought the worry was worth it. Like hand-me-down clothes, the legacy of the Haint faded as the years went by. For a few years, the Haint's appearance and Chacha's triumph over it remained an indisputable, evergreen truth. It didn't matter that no subsequent resident of the big room had a night to rival Chacha's. None of them ever admitted to hearing so much as a tap on the window during their times there. The original event was so remarkable that it did not require repetition. Chacha took on an elevated status among the first 6 children. He had landed a punch on a Haint and was somehow still breathing. But with each additional child who came along, the story lost some of its luster. By the time it reached Layla, the 13th and final Turner child, Francis Turner's 5-word rebuttal, "Ain't no Haints in Detroit," was more famous within the family than the story behind it. It first gained a place in the Turner lexicon as a way to refute a claim, especially one that very well might be true, a signal of the speaker's refusal to discuss the matter further. The first 6, confident that Francis Turner secretly believed in the Haint's existence, popularized this usage. By Layla's youth, the phrase had mutated into an accusation of leg pulling. "Daddy said if I get an A in Mrs. Paulson's, he'd let me come on his truck and trip to Oregon." "Oregon, come on, man. Ain't no Haints in Detroit." So I'm jumping forward. Chacha is now 64 years old. Speak something into existence. Give it a name and give it life. Had Chacha done this? Did he believe this could be done? Certainly not after so many years of relative peace and not as quickly as it was happening. There was someone, something, sitting on the windowsill in Chacha's bedroom. This is how it begins. A moth-like sound in the light tube blue in the corner of your bedroom. If you ignore it, it does not exist. But speak its name and you've invited it into your mind. Like hearing voices or seeing the face of Christ in a freshly laundered shirt. What happens cannot be manipulated, refuses to be controlled, but what we acknowledge as having occurred. What we tell others can metastasize, grow ubiquitous overnight. He'd acknowledged it there in his therapist Alice's office, and now the control he had over what happened was gone. Chacha hadn't started recording his feelings, as Alice suggested, or thought about patterns, or visited the big room, but he had started remembering. He couldn't show Tina because Tina was on a women's ministry retreat. Somewhere along Lake Huron, she slept on a cabin bunk with proverbs swirling through her dreams. He couldn't carry or wheel Viola in to see his haint because his mother's sleep was precious. He couldn't even get out of his bed and down on his knees to pray like he had prayed so long ago because the truth was that he couldn't move. Fear paralyzed him as much as surprise and disappointment with himself. He awoke because he felt the air in the room shift, as subtle as a single hair falling on his skin, and tried to keep his eyes closed. A futile attempt because the noise was still there, too, like the beating of wings so papery and thin a drop of water could dissolve them. He recognized the sound. 2 hours and the light on the windowsill hadn't moved, just an orb of brightness like the spots of light one saw after blinking too fast. It hadn't condensed into the glowing, wispy-haired man-child marauder of the big room, hadn't grabbed him by his ashy foot and dragged him into the dewy April night. This was a surprise, no confrontation at all. I am here, was all it seemed to want to say. I have always been here. So, he sees the haint again, finally does tell his wife Tina and his mother, Viola, and his therapist, and they don't believe him. The following afternoon, he decided to contact his siblings. He had no friends, and the sleepless nights made him desperate. Plus, Alice had told him several months before that he needed to start tapping into his resources for emotional support, seeking help from the people he helped all the time. Francie, second child, 62 years old. You want to know what I remember from the actual incident? Honestly, I've been thinking about this more and more since you came over and put in my filter. Now that I stopped eating meat, I feel like I can remember all sorts of things better, you know? Like it's all high def now. Of course I remember thinking there was a haint up in your room. And what, Cha-Cha? We were young, and when I moved into the big room, I didn't have any problems, so I don't know. You've been reading that Zora book? A little. I've been reading up on hallucinations, too. Jesus, don't read that, child. You're not hallucinating. According to Alice, I might be. I don't think I am, but you need to let go of that Western mindset. I keep telling you. Had I listened to them after I got sick, I'd have ruined my liver and kidneys by now, taking a million pills a day. These white folks don't know everything. Trust me, Alice isn't white. Still, you know what I mean. Anyway, what's going on with the house? Rahul told me that you could maybe get some type of tax write-off if you short sell it. Francie, do you remember what it looked like? It was blue, wasn't it? He didn't show us the form yet. He said it's called an MIX form, or MI2 maybe, if you want to look it up. Quincy, third child, 59 years old. The problem is all those women up there with you. You know I love our sisters, Cha, but they're hysterical. I don't doubt they drive me crazy too. I'm not crazy, Quincy. Of course you're not crazy. You're my big brother and a Turner man. Listen to me though, that hate might be real. It might just be in your imagination, I don't know. But your reaction to it is a choice. All this hysteria over a ghost? You can unchoose that, Cha. Turner men don't choose hysteria. Russell, fourth child, 57 years old. Tina said you upset Mama, and every time I call Mama, she says she ain't up to talk. Mama's confused, Russell, and that's not what I called to talk about. Well, what'd you call for then? I called about that haint from the big room. I want to know what you remember. All I remember was what Daddy said. I know what Daddy said, Russell. Come on now. You remember the haint as being real, don't you? Sure it's real. Or was real. No one ever saw again, so that's got to mean something, too. I saw it on Sunday and every night since, plus that time when I had my accident. Aw, nobody thinks you really saw it when you had that crash. Tell you the truth, we all thought it was in painkillers. So you're telling me it could only happen once on Yarrow Street and then never again? Sure, isn't that how the world works? We were all just at the wrong place at the wrong time back then, or at the right place at the right time, depending on how you look at it. You should really read the emails I send out, child. They're all about miracles and chance encounters. Things like that only happen once. Marlene, fifth child, 55 years old, via text message, part one of two. I'm too upset to pick up the phone. I hear you're moving forward with the short sale. If you sell the house, I will never forgive you. I don't put down my part two of two foot on anything in this family. Not ever. But you do this and you break my heart. Not trying to be dramatic, just how I feel. Lonnie, sixth child, 53 years old. That was the only time I remember peeing on myself. Ain't that something? I was what, three? And I just stopped cold turkey after that night. I could never forget that. What'd you say if I told you I saw the haint again in my own house? I believe you. Why wouldn't I, child? I don't know. Thank you, Lonnie. Lonnie? I'm here. I'm looking for the back of my earring. I figured out it's easier to locate things when I take a minute to be quiet. Oh, can you stop looking until after we hang up? Sure, Cha. Thank you. You're the first person out of everybody to really say they believe me. I am? God, you know, sometimes our siblings disappoint me, Cha. I know, but I don't think they need to. I hope they don't. But anyhow, I'm glad you believe me. The problem is now I can't sleep anywhere in the house without seeing it. I'm not really talking to Tina, and I'm sleeping on the couch, and my back and hip is hurting. I even tried the basement, and it's there too, no matter where I go. It's still only showing up at night, though. I don't know what to do. You only got one option. Or two, actually. You could pray really hard, but knowing you and Tina, y'all already tried that. So two, you could try to talk to it. And say what? Shit. Lonnie? Lonnie, are you all right? Huh? I'm here. I just lost the stud. I wasn't thinking, and I kept the stud in my ear while I was looking for the back, and it fell out too. Shit. I bet you this ear's gonna close up. This is my third time this year, Chop. First, I got the wrong ear. I forgot that the writer's for Sissy, so then I took that one out, and I got another one put in the left ear, but then I was visiting some girl in Hawthorne, and God damn it, Lonnie, I'm trying to talk to you about something serious. Hello? I'm still here, Cha-Cha. I'm sorry. I haven't eaten all day, and you know how I get when I'm lightheaded. It's fine. You were saying I shouldn't talk to the Hank? What should I say? I'm not trying to fool around with any seances or them Ouija boards. Francie's acting like I need to take it back to Africa to figure this out, but I don't know how she expects me to do that. To tell you the truth, this sounds like some kind of reckoning. And you gotta take heed of it, Cha, not be scared of it. A reckoning for what? Wait, why haven't you eaten yet? It's already 3 o'clock in LA. You need some money? Money? No, I get my check on the first, so that's what, a couple more days. I still got some stuff around here I can eat. I'm gonna send you $100. Thank you, Cha-Cha. I really appreciate it. It's nothing. I just been down a little lately, Azon. I'm trying to figure out why. This girl from Hawthorne, Lily, Lonnie, what's that you said about taking heed? Huh? Truth is, Cha-Cha, I can't call it. Maybe you shouldn't even talk to it. Just listen harder. If you need someplace to go for a while and think, you can come here. It's just me in this apartment, and I get paid on the first. Nettie, seventh child, 50 years old, from turnergal7 at coolmail.com to cturner1 at isses.net. Subject, re, I need to talk to you. Auto-reply, vacation away message. Namaste. I'm on vacation in India. We'll return May 29th. If this is work-related, please contact my second-in-command, Michelle Dozier. Kisses from the Taj Mahal, Antoinette Turner. Be the change you wish to see in the world, Gandhi. Miles and Duke, 8th and 9th children, 48 and 47 years old. Cha-Cha, what's going on? Hey, what's all that noise? I'm up in Oakland with Duke. It's Padres versus A's. Hold on, let me put him on the phone. Never mind, I'll... Cha! Miles is over here talking about a blowout. He thinks Padres are finna win by 3 runs. I got 50 says he's talking out the side of his neck you want to put in. Give me the phone back. That's enough of that, Cha. Cha, it's Miles again. Don't listen to Duke. He's drunk. You need to come out here during football season. Me and the girls usually drive up from San Diego the night before. Everybody starts partying at 8 in the morning. Y'all try to tailgate like that over around Ford Field. Somebody's liable to end up shot. Cha-Cha? Cha-Cha, hey, Duke, why don't you tell me you already hung up? Bernice, 10th child, 45 years old. Funniest thing, Cha-Cha, I wouldn't have believed you 3 years ago, but did I ever tell you about the last time I visited Mama on Yarrow? Last June, right before she got real sick, and I stayed a whole week. No, what happened? Well, we were driving to church, and I was driving, and Mama was riding, and I was gonna go up Seneca to Gratiot. I don't know why, I just felt like it. But Mama said, don't you go up Seneca, Niecy. And I said, why, Mama? What difference does it make? I think I sounded kind of smart, but I didn't mean to. You know Mama's the queen of backseat driving, even though she was up front that day, but you know what I mean. Anyway, so I asked her why, and she said, they killed 2 boys on Seneca in Medbury, and I don't want to pass that corner by. It's like there's Haints over there now. It don't feel right. And I said, what you mean, Haints on the corner of Seneca and Medbury? Because all I know about Haints is that joke y'all used to say about Daddy. Mama didn't answer me, and I didn't push it because I was scared Mama was having a senior moment, you know? Now I guess I should have asked more questions, like did she actually see ghosts there, or was she just being dramatic? But like I said, I was scared, so I left it alone, and I went up Maxwell instead. A couple days later, I was driving to the store by myself, and I took Seneca. Sure enough, right on the corner in front of the light pole, somebody had set up one of those shrines with the stuffed animals and the candles like they do when somebody's been shot or hit by a car. My God. I know, right? It's scary. I mean, could have also just been a figure of speech. She could have read about the shooting or saw it on the news. I don't know. But let me say this too, Cha. You be careful who you go around asking about this. Everybody ain't so open-minded. Hell, I wasn't open to this before last June, and I still have my doubts. No offense. Thank you.